Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone, and happy Martin Luther King Day. Later this morning, we will compare how textbooks in California and Texas teach kids about race and racial justice. They're more different than you might imagine, or they may be as different as you might imagine. We'll talk to Patrice Kahn Cullors today, one of the three women who founded Black Lives Matter, on how she tries to build on the legacy of Dr. King. And we will go live in the 11 o'clock hour to Richmond, Virginia, where the gun rights rally that has everyone so on edge will be taking place amid the reports by Virginia's governor that white supremacists may try to turn it into another Charlottesville. That's supposed to be just a one-hour rally, and it is next hour, and we will get a report from Richmond live during it. But with the trial of Donald Trump set to begin in the Senate tomorrow, we will begin today on the impeachment news. When the impeachment trial begins at 1 o'clock tomorrow, the first thing they'll do is organize the rules. If it goes like the Clinton impeachment, each side would have 24 hours to make their opening arguments. That could be about 10 afternoons of arguments. Then each side would have 16 hours for senators to ask questions of the lawyers for each side. Probably only then would there be a vote on witnesses or additional documents. The marquee news over the weekend, as you probably heard, was that Trump has named Harvard Law Professor Alan Dershowitz and Clinton impeachment prosecutor Ken Starr to his legal team. Dershowitz previewed his role yesterday on CNN's State of the Union.
I'm making what could be the most important argument on the floor of the Senate, namely that even if everything that is alleged by the House managers is proven or taken as true, they would not rise to the level of an impeachable offense. I will be paraphrasing the successful argument made by Justice Benjamin Curtis in the trial of Andrew Johnson back in the 1860s. Where he argued that the framers intended for impeachable conduct only to be criminal-like conduct.
Alan Dershowitz yesterday. With me now is Time Magazine congressional correspondent Alana Abramson, who is following the impeachment proceedings. Hi, Alana. Thanks for coming on.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me this morning.
Can you explain where Dershowitz and Starr fit into the president's overall defense strategy?
Yeah, so for the majority of this process, the White House has actually declined to participate. They were given an opportunity during the Judiciary Committee and did not appear. The White House Counsel's Office has largely been helming this process. But on Friday, the White House announced that they had hired additional members of their team to present their arguments for why Trump should not be removed from office at the upcoming Senate trial. And that includes Starr, Dershowitz, and Robert Ray.
In the clip we just played, Dershowitz says his argument will be about not rising to the level of impeachment, even if it's all true. Do you know how he'll make that case?
We don't know how he'll make that case. So the White House originally filed a 7-page response to the House's brief, which was filed on Saturday. And Dershowitz was actually not on that response. It was just two other White House counsel attorneys. But that response didn't necessarily say a ton about why it's not impeachable. It was more focusing on the fact that the House's arguments as a whole were completely invalid. So it sounds a little bit like Dershowitz is going for a bit more nuanced argument than what was presented on Saturday evening by the White House.
In the clip we played, Dershowitz says what his role will be, making the case that even if Trump did everything he's accused of, it doesn't rise to the level of impeachment under the Constitution. What role will Ken Starr play if that's as known?
Ken Starr, I think, will be likely front and center at the trial. I mean, I think you'll see him giving the arguments on behalf of the White House and the president and arguing that this is not impeachable conduct, just like Dershowitz will be.
What would the Democrats' argument likely be, if you know yet, on the other side of the impeachability question?
Yeah, so the Democrats filed a much more extensive brief on Saturday evening. It was 111 pages and effectively laid out their argument. And overall, I mean, you saw some new information that had been released since the articles of impeachment were filed, but their argument mostly remains the same, that Trump abused the power of his office through his call with the Ukrainian president, and that he subsequently obstructed Congress, and that he's, you know, a danger to the Republic, and his behavior warrants removal from office.
Do the Democrats believe that Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler and the five other impeachment managers can be as effective on TV as Dershowitz and Ken Starr, who are, you know, larger than life figures on Fox News and elsewhere? I'm curious how the appointment of these two marquee names has shaken up the Democrats' approach, if at all.
I don't really think it's shaken up their approach. I mean, I think they always thought the White House was going to continue to push back on their arguments. I think that Pelosi probably had in mind that the White House was going to ultimately craft a strong legal team when she picked these managers, which is why she picked this group of seven people who, you know, are very schooled in the facts. They've helmed the Schiff and Nadler have helmed the process so far. They know the arguments they're making. The majority of them hold law degrees. So I think, you know, they think that they can give the White House legal team a run for their money.
Listeners, we can take questions for our guest, Alanna Abramson, congressional correspondent from Time magazine, as we preview the impeachment trial of Donald Trump, which will begin tomorrow at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. They are projecting a 1 o'clock start time each day. We will have live coverage tomorrow here on WNYC beginning at noon, as NPR will begin with an hour of preview. And it does seem like there may be some even pre-1 o'clock activity that we'll try to find out about in a minute, but our coverage begins at noon tomorrow, so laying down that marker. But your questions right now about what might happen or what is happening, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Alanna, what will happen tomorrow? What's the first thing that will happen?
So the first thing that will happen is obviously, you know, the senators will file into the chamber, and then presumably John Roberts, the Chief Justice, will call the proceedings to order. And at that point, all we really know is that there will be a debate on the rules shaping the contours of the trial. So McConnell has said, Senate Majority Mitch McConnell has said that he wants to emulate the rules from Bill Clinton's 1999 impeachment trial, but has yet to actually show the text of what his rules will look like. So we presume that as soon as, you know, everyone's convened, we will see that resolution.
We've been hearing that Democratic leader Chuck Schumer will force a number of votes in this initial debate over the rules. What can he do even without having the majority?
He can basically be an annoyance to McConnell, to put it a little bit bluntly. I mean, he can force as many votes as possible to try and make his point from a rhetorical perspective about what he thinks should happen with the trial. It's unlikely that he will get, he needs the majority of senators to pass whatever votes he's forcing. And it's probably unlikely that he will get that, but he will still make his intentions known and can broadcast to the public what he's trying to do.
The length of opening arguments from the Clinton trial, 24 hours for each side's opening argument. Is that what McConnell wants for this? Because I've also read that he may want to cut that in half to 12 and 12.
So again, we don't really know what McConnell will do tomorrow because we have not seen the text of his resolution. But yes, if he's going by the Clinton precedent, then each side gets 24 hours. There's concern, though, that if they give each side 24 hours, Senator David Perdue said on NBC yesterday that they could cram it into 2 days of 12-hour arguments, which would effectively mean that because the trial starts at 1, it would go until midnight, 1 a.m., and Democrats are not happy with that. They said that that is basically covering up the process so the public can't see it. So we do know vaguely that if McConnell adheres to the Clinton precedent, that there will be 24 hours for each side, but we don't know the number of days that it'll be stretched out over.
Yeah, because presumably If it is 24 hours and they do just follow the 1 p.m. to 6 p.m. schedule that they followed during Clinton, that's like 5 hours a day for 5 days for each side on the schedule that they would be keeping. Why would it take that long just for opening arguments in the first place?
Well, I mean, the trial is effectively trying to persuade the senators who are the jurors, but it's also trying to persuade public opinion. So, you know, they really have the court, or essentially, during those 24 hours. And it makes the most sense for them to maximize on that and use all of that solely to prove the arguments that they're trying to make. And again, if it's stretched out over 4 hours, they basically have four. If it's stretched out over 4 days, they essentially have all of those days to make their case. And I think that maximizes public attention.
And then the 16 hours of senators submitting questions, if it goes like the Clinton process, how would that work?
So the senators would submit their questions, and then at that point, again, it's all kind of confusing because we don't know exactly what McConnell will say in his text, but the senators would submit written questions, and then I believe that from there they could decide which ones would be heard. But their questions would all be written.
And then Justice Roberts reads the questions out loud, not the senators. Do you know if the Senate questioners get identified by name by the Chief Justice when he's reading their questions?
I do not know that, actually.
That would be interesting. It would be weird if it's not. I don't know the answer to that either. But it would be weird if, you know, he can't say, this question comes from Senator John Kennedy, Republican of Louisiana, or whoever it happens to be. On the question of witnesses, here's Dershowitz again on CNN yesterday.
The one thing the Constitution would require is if witnesses are called on one side, they have to be called on the other side. What I would think is wait until after all the opening arguments are made. Let's see if witnesses are called for. And if they are, the trial will take a much longer time because the Democrats will call John Bolton. The president will invoke executive privilege. It will have to go to the courts. The courts will resolve it.
So, Alana, there are two common controversies in that one clip. Witness reciprocity, you might call it. If the Democrats get to call Bolton or whoever, then the Republicans get to call witnesses of their choice. We know they want Hunter Biden, maybe the whistleblower, maybe Joe Biden. And then there's the question of executive privilege and John Bolton. Can you talk about that one? Dershowitz makes it sound in that clip like Bolton will never testify in this proceeding because his appearance will get tied up in the courts until well after it's done. Is that a given?
You know, I think it could actually go either way. I think the White House could invoke an executive privilege. I think that Bolton would likely get taken to the higher courts, but I think there are probably some legal people out there who could argue that Bolton maybe still be able to testify. And again, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not completely familiar with the arguments, but I don't necessarily know if it's a given that we won't hear from Bolton.
But now here's Ken Starr with the Trump Team Now, back in 1999 when he was prosecuting Clinton.
With respect to this phase of the investigation, the administration has been uncooperative. To the contrary, it has litigated numerous issues. It may very well be that the considered judgment of this body is any privilege can be invoked, no matter how unmeritorious one thinks it is, that that's not an abuse. I disagree with that.
Ken Starr arguing against executive privilege in that trial in which he was the prosecutor in 1999. But there are also contradictions on the other side as well. Chuck Schumer argued against witnesses in 1999. Do the contradictions on either side matter to the politics of now or to what actually happens in this proceeding?
I mean, I think they matter in the sense that each side will use the other one's contradictions to prove their own points. But in terms of what it actually means for what happens in the trial, I don't think it matters at all. I think that Ken Starr could easily still argue to invoke executive privilege regarding Bolton. And, you know, Schumer and the Democrats may say, look what he said 20 years ago, but ultimately it won't matter.
Let's take a phone call. Hillary in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hello, Hillary.
Hello. Just let me get you off speaker now. Hi. My 2 points. First of all, what you said at the outset, Brian, about Ken Starr and Dershowitz being the star defense attorneys or whatever, they're both tainted individuals. Starr with this Baylor University.
Yes, he was the president of Baylor University. Yeah. And for people who don't know this, it's a great irony considering that he prosecuted Clinton for things related to the affair with Monica Lewinsky. He had to resign as president of Baylor University because he was seen as not tough enough on sexual misconduct taking place on campus.
Yes, and Dershowitz has been implicated in the Epstein, the Jeffrey Epstein young women sex abuse issue. Which he, I don't know whether he, whether that's, he's been proven guilty in that, or I guess not. Anyway, the other...
Well, he was a lawyer.
But he was one of the people who, it's been said that he was one of the patrons of Epstein's business model. Did you not hear that?
I have not heard that. I would have to double check it. I'm not saying it's not true, but I have not heard that. But at very least, Alana, Democrats are pointing to the fact that I believe both Dershowitz and Starr have been defense lawyers for the late convicted sexual predator Jeffrey Epstein. Trump didn't care about that history when he tagged them for this role?
I don't believe he did, no. I don't really think that. I would have to check with my colleagues who cover the White House, but I don't believe that was a factor. I think they were likely looking at who they think could make the best arguments on his behalf.
And I did see Dershowitz in that same CNN interview yesterday say, look, this is what I do as a high-profile defense attorney. I defend high-profile defendants who were unpopular. So he pointed to the fact that he also defended O.J. Simpson, as well as Jeffrey Epstein and Michael Milken and others. He feels that every person deserves a defense. You know, you could go into whole other realms of society where poor people or people of color or suspected terrorists or whoever who are dismissed or treated, you know, with contempt by society, even if deservedly so in any individual's case, that they deserve a vigorous defense by a lawyer. And that's Dershowitz's argument for why he took the Jeffrey Epstein case and should not be seen negatively as a result of that. Of course, one could argue that an attorney picks his clients. He didn't have to defend Jeffrey Epstein for whatever reason. He saw Jeffrey Epstein as worthy of his time and star power. And so that controversy is out there.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Well, let's take another call. We're going to go next to David in Englewood. David, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling.
Yes, I want to make 3 points. I'll make them very quick. And one is that I don't see how people can really take this seriously when you have Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, signing a document and then handing out the pens as if this were some kind of carnival. This is some kind of celebratory mode. Now, secondly, the House conducted focus groups on what words to use and what would go over with the public. I mean, this is a serious matter. And yet, it's taken like, oh, well, this is a joke. And thirdly, I don't see how you can defame any lawyer for taking a client. I mean, it's not Alan Dershowitz's view that everybody deserves competent counsel, no matter how bad a person they are. I think that's in the Constitution, I believe. And so if any one of us was accused of a crime, no matter how bad it was, we're entitled to counsel before we can be proven guilty. And by the way, why doesn't anyone ever talk about George Stephanopoulos? Wasn't he one of the people that attended a party when Epstein was released from prison?
I'm not familiar with the George Stephanopoulos case, but of course, all kinds of people, Bill Clinton, all kinds of people are getting tarred by their associations with Jeffrey Epstein. David, let me ask you a question as a Trump supporter in this case.
Well, no, I am a conservative.
But you don't think that he should be removed from office, I take it.
I don't think that this reaches that level. I didn't think that Clinton's articles reached the level of removal. I mean, removal from office is something, I mean, that should be reserved for, like, the worst of the worst. I mean, politicians lie every day. So, no, I don't think Clinton or this rises to that level. And the way it's been conducted is ridiculous.
David, thank you for your call. Call us again. So, Alana, let me go back to you on some of the points that David raised. From an image perspective with respect to Pelosi and the Democrats, that incident with the pens, what exactly happened there? Were you aware of that?
Yeah, so I was actually in the room when Pelosi signed the articles, and I noticed that there were these pens, and I asked one of the staffers, and they just said, you know, this is routine. She has pens at most signings. I know that Twitter kind of went crazy because they handed out pens to each of the impeachment managers. But I do think that overall, Pelosi has worked very hard to strike a very solemn tone during these proceedings. As someone who's watched them from the beginning, I mean, you saw that she basically shushed people when they were cheering during the actual impeachment process last year in December. And I think that she's made it very clear that she does not think this is a celebratory thing. She does not think that her caucus should be acting like it's a celebratory thing. I mean, you saw Hakeem Jeffries on Fox yesterday saying it was a very sober moment. None of us really wanted to be doing this. So I think that the pens shouldn't be looked at in isolation.
And this is part of the essence of the argument that Democrats and Republicans are having with each other over this. We focused a little bit on this on Friday's show. That the Democrats are portraying this as a solemn occasion, and the Republicans are going, oh, come on, don't give me this solemn occasion crap. This is partisan. You're just trying to get Trump out of office. You've been trying to do it from the start. So that's the political tone of one side or the other, regardless of who you believe.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely right, and I think that Pelosi has been asked this question multiple times by reporters, and quite notably, the people who she has picked to lead first the inquiry and then subsequently the actual prosecution via the impeachment managers were not people who necessarily were gung-ho about the impeachment from the start. I mean, Schiff said multiple times during his public hearings that he did not want to go down that route. Pelosi has said she did not want to go down that route. Really, none of them are the people who have been on the front lines of pushing impeachment. Nadler did show a little bit more of an indication earlier in the process, but still, he mostly followed Pelosi, who said that we do not want to do this until we absolutely have to.
Right. And this is another case, I think, of Trump using his frequent tactic of accusing his critics of doing exactly what he's actually done with a fake moral equivalence, but that enough people buy into. So his team is saying the House of Representatives is interfering in the 2020 election. They actually used that term in the brief that the White House released, right? The House interfering in the 2020 election by bringing impeachment charges now. We know, just as a matter of factual reporting, that Pelosi, as you were just referring to, never saw this as a political winner and only felt forced into it after this Ukraine incident revealed Trump was doing something even more serious and brazen with Ukraine than he did with Russia in 2016, at least more out in the open. I don't know. He was out in the open with Russia. He did say, Russia, if you're listening, go find Hillary Clinton's email. So maybe it's the opposite. As I'm thinking out loud, maybe this was supposed to be more less out in the open and he got caught. But he couldn't let but the Democrats felt that they couldn't let this stand unresponded to for the sake of not setting authoritarian precedents. but enough of the people to keep Trump in office may apparently believe the House is just doing this to weaken him for the election or just to overturn the 2016 election. So in this, which is not a court of law, detailed facts don't matter necessarily to the outcome. What matters is keeping enough Fox viewers in the House on his side that they won't flip their Republican senators, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think that, you know, the House Democrats have a very clear established fact pattern that, and they note several times, I mean, I was on a call with Democratic aides working on the inquiry, and they noted several times that the White House never refuted any of the facts, but you just have a president who's exceedingly popular with the Republican base, and Republican senators, I mean, they're representing their constituents. They don't want to turn against that. So I don't know if they necessarily think that what he did warrants removal from office, but I think that you can't ignore the fact that there is a very strong Republican base support for the president.
And the Republican brief, the president's brief that was released over the weekend, makes all the arguments we've heard through this process. But the brief did not deny any of the evidence or the claims of what actions the president actually took. So Trump asked Ukraine to announce a Biden investigation because he was concerned about corruption. No. Trump withheld military aid as leverage against corruption and because Europe should be doing more of that funding. No. Or maybe those were, maybe he wanted Europe to be doing more funding as well. And he did mention that in the phone call with Zelensky. But primarily it was about getting an announcement of an investigation against Biden. And there was no quid pro quo because the president said there was no quid pro quo, even though there was all this evidence that there was. So the actual evidence is so overwhelming on the basic questions that they don't even refute it in the White House brief. Did Trump ask a foreign country to interfere in our election? Yes. Did he direct the withholding of meetings and military aid to pressure Ukraine to announce a Biden investigation? Yes. Did he use his power on this solely for his personal gain because he never asked Ukraine to deal with any other kinds of corruption? Yes. It's all proven with multiple documents and first-person witness testimony by his own appointees. So, Alana, how did they skirt this in the White House brief released over the weekend?
I mean, they basically, the brief was 7 pages, and they basically said that Democrats should not be bringing articles of impeachment. The first line, I have it up right now, is the articles of impeachment submitted by House Democrats are a dangerous attack on the right of American people to freely choose their president. So they're basically saying that Democrats should not even be doing this because they're overturning the will of the people and they're, you know, going beyond their authority, even though it's explicitly laid out in the Constitution that Democrats have the right. I mean, that the House of Representatives, you know, has the right to conduct impeachment, and that's the right of Congress. But that's basically what they're saying. They're saying, you know, this is Democrats are just they don't like Trump. They've always wanted to do this. It doesn't even really matter what all of the facts are, because all they want to do is overturn the election.
Gene in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Gene.
Hi. I have a question about the mechanics of the procedure. How many lawyers does President Trump have, and who is paying for all of these lawyers? And if the American taxpayer is paying for all of them, are we entitled to know how much money is being spent in his defense?
Good questions. Alana, do you know the answer to either how many lawyers the president is permitted to have or if the public is paying for them?
I don't know the answers to that. That's a good question that I will now be asking. I actually don't know the answers, but I don't believe that there is a limit on the amount of lawyers. Don't hold me to that, but I don't think that would be laid out. And then I know that, you know, it's unclear who's paying. Giuliani, for instance, I believe is working free of charge for the president, although that's in his personal capacity. So these are good questions that I will need to look into.
And the Democrats do have 7 impeachment managers. There were even more on the Republican side when they were the House impeachment managers for the Clinton process. I think there were a dozen. So I'm not sure that the number of defense attorneys is going to rise to much of a level of controversy, because the House can name, you know, somewhere between 7 and 12. They named 7 in this case, and the White House gets to name a number of defense attorneys as well. I guess it could become controversial if people like Dershowitz and Starr are being brought in from the outside and the public has to pay for this defense. But, you know, other people might argue this is a government proceeding. It's a process over whether the president of the United States should be removed from office by the Congress of the United States. And so both sides of that get a publicly funded defense. We left the question on the table earlier of Alan Dershowitz and accusations that he participated in sexual assault with women provided by Jeffrey Epstein. This is a Washington Post article from November 8th. Headline, Alan Dershowitz countersues accuser in Jeffrey Epstein case, then is sued by David Boies. And it starts, Harvard law professor Alan Dershowitz accused by a woman of sexually assaulting her when she was a teenager under the control of sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein has now sued the woman in federal court in New York, claiming that her allegations are lies, disparagement, defamation, harassment that are beyond the bounds of decency and not tolerated in civilized society. Those words from Dershowitz's suit. Dershowitz repeated his previous claims that Virginia Roberts Giffrey was pressured to falsely accuse Dershowitz by her lawyers, namely the law firm headed by the renowned attorney David Boies. So Boies fired back with his own defamation suit against Dershowitz, saying in an effort to distract attention from his own misconduct, Dershowitz has engaged in a campaign to attack and vilify each of the lawyers who have represented his victims, one of which is Boies, the head of the Boies Schiller Flexner law firm. So, Alana and everybody, there's a little bit of background on the accusation against Alan Dershowitz and the suits and countersuits that have arisen in recent months since. And I guess the question on the table right now is, how does any of that affect the impeachment trial of Donald Trump? Do you think it might, one way or the other, in the court of public opinion?
I don't. I mean, I think that the only way I think it could possibly impact the trial is if Dershowitz's role in all of this becomes overwhelming and supersedes coverage of the trial. And then I think, you know, we might be in different territory. But I don't really think it will matter. I mean, I think the people who already believe Trump should not be removed from office likely won't be swayed based on Dershowitz's prior cases. And I think that the people who think that he should be removed from office will just be like, okay, this is another, you know, feather in the hat.
It could be that people retreat to their corners, as in the case of the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, with respect to who they believe. And, you know, from a political analysis standpoint, I'm guessing that Trump figures this will benefit him. Because again, all he needs to do is keep Fox News viewers buying enough of his talking points and enough of the narrative of who the aggrieved parties are, in this case, he might say himself and Alan Dershowitz, that there won't be enough of a change of public opinion in states with Republican senators that they'll have to flip and convict.
I think that's right. I mean, I think the White House's entire strategy this whole time has been maximize the base, make sure that no one on the base ever thinks he should be removed from office. And I think we're seeing that. I think that, you know, support among Republicans for Trump has remained solid throughout this process.
Let me take one more call. Nick, you're on the air. Hi, Nick. Thank you for calling in.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. Two quick points. I think Nancy Pelosi should have chosen Justin Amash as one of the managers He was a former Republican, and he's one of the most eloquent, articulate spokesmen in favor of Trump's impeachment. So I think Nancy Pelosi made a mistake there. I also think Democrats should take any deal to get John Bolton to testify. If Republicans want Hunter and Joe Biden, they should. Hunter and Joe should testify. They helped get us in this mess with their behavior with Ukraine. I don't think they did anything illegal, but I just think Biden should not get a free pass. If Republicans want Biden to get Bolton, I say take the deal.
Nick, thank you very much. Alana, let's take both of his points before we run out of time. On Justin Amash, you certainly could make a case that Justin Amash, who left the Republican Party over this, would have been a very strong impeachment manager. Why isn't he there?
I think Pelosi didn't select him. There were several moderate Democrats who came up with this idea to push Amash as an impeachment manager, and ultimately Pelosi decided that was not the way she was going to go. She did not select him as part of the group, and I think she's very happy with the group she's assembled.
Even at the same time on the other side, Dershowitz, again on TV, I believe in the past he has said, I didn't vote for Donald Trump. I'm not a Trump supporter. He's got a reputation as a liberal, at least on some things in the past. And so Trump is playing that card, but Pelosi isn't.
I think you can look at it that way. I would argue that Dershowitz might be viewed as more polarizing and more, at least more well, maybe because he's more well known than Amash. But I don't really think that anyone would point at Trump's legal team and say, look at this bipartisan group that he's assembled.
Fair enough. And on the other question of either of the Bidens testifying, we've had calls on this show from a few people now who've said Joe Biden didn't do anything wrong. The callers don't believe, but he should testify. Go ahead, use it as leverage to force Bolton's testimony or whoever's on the other side, and let the Republicans, you know, fruitlessly question him, trying to prove some kind of corruption that doesn't exist. And to this caller's point, thereby allowing Joe Biden to get them out of the mess that on some level he helped get them into by his son Hunter taking that role.
Yeah, so McConnell has said that he said at his press conference last week that he would be open to the idea of witness reciprocity. Democrats have been pretty clear that they don't think Hunter Biden can offer much in the way of facts on the investigation, and that he would essentially just kind of be a showpiece for the Republicans to question and, you know, raise ratings essentially. But Joe Biden has not been mentioned as much. They did lay out explicitly in a brief that Joe Biden, you know, there nothing has ever been proven that he did anything wrong. He was just following the U.S.-Ukrainian policy during his work under Obama. So I will see what happens, but Democrats have been very clear that they don't think Hunter Biden would offer a lot.
Alana Abramson, Time Magazine congressional correspondent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.